It is Tacky Talk time here on Quincy Access Television with State Representative Tacky Chan of Quincy. How are you, Tacky?
Doing good, Joe. Good to see you on a Tuesday for a change, the 26th of July, and much cooler day. We finally get a break from the heat wave.
Yes, it's only going to be in the 80s instead of in the 90s, so that'll feel just very refreshing.
Well, it's been walking like in soup the last several days. I try to get things done, like, you know, shopping, I mean, life things, and it's been really walking in soup.
Really has been. It's unhealthy, too, especially for folks who have respiratory issues. So this will be a nice relief, although I'm sure it'll be back in short order.
Well, it's people are complaining about the slow warm up of the summer. And now it's here. Most of us can't wait to get to the fall.
Be careful what you wish for. Exactly.
Exactly. But you're absolutely correct. The air quality has been really hard, especially extremely dense air that holds on to pollution because the water particles in the air will hold on to particulates. And folks with a little more respiratory challenges will find it a little harder to breathe, and they should definitely take it slower. As we talked about before, I mean, you know, stay indoors, stay cool. If you've got an air filtration system, definitely take advantage of using your air filter, purifier systems. And, you know, again, I mean, don't leave your cars, pets, kids, in cars, even though it's going to be in the 80s, as you point out, it's too dangerous to do so.
Oh, yeah. It gets very hot in a vehicle very, very quickly, for sure. Last week in July also means the last week of the formal legislative session on Beacon Hill, right?
It is. We're still operating under emergency rules from COVID-19. There seemed no reason to change from emergency rules once we reach a more living with the virus this past, you know, January to April. So this means that, you know, we can continue to have formal sessions if we desire to end of the legislative cycle. But the decision has been made by both House and leadership to avoid that unless there's an extreme emergency to do so. That means we're going to try to operate as if, you know, pre-COVID schedule is what we're trying to maintain. As a result, formal sessions will end midnight, August 1st, July 31st is the last day. And, you know, try to get our things done then. Now, again, a formal session means we all convene and we actually take votes. Informal sessions by law require to happen every 72 hours, which means you can move bills by unanimous consent and a voice vote. There's no need for a roll call vote. And there's still opportunities to move legislation after July 31st in informal sessions. This is not necessarily unusual. We do this actually more often than people realize, especially on local initiatives, small tentacle bills, things that don't raise a larger controversy that requires a vote, and even small supplemental budgets, just strictly bill paying or transfer of accounts between one account and another account in administration. Not surprising, it's often done in informal session. There's already agreement between both political parties, as well as the governor's office of these small transitory issues that doesn't really impact the taxpayers. It just moves one account to another account. It's fairly routine. So, you know, we are shutting down formal sessions, but that is not the close of session. And, you know, other pieces of legislation will keep moving forward as the remaining months are here to swearing in day in January.
Since last we talked, I believe actually the day that we talked, there was a climate change bill that was being debated, and I think it got reported out, did it not?
Yeah, a deal broke last week. Amazing what a president does to motivate our counterparts in the Senate to cut a deal faster and reached a fairly good compromise in my mind. As a reminder, folks, I mean, we work in this business, you're never going to get everything you want. There's multiple parties of interest, but you need to come to an agreement to move the greater issue forward. And, you know, Chairman Jeff Roy out of Franklin, the House Telecommunication Utilities Energy Chair, did an incredibly good job on this, as well as working with the Minority Leader, Brad Jones, from North Reading. I mean, he was remarkable, contributed to this entire process from the House standpoint to support the House position throughout the bill. You know, we have Senator Barrett, who's the House Senate Chair of Telecommunication Utilities Energy, as well as Cindy Cream, the Majority Leader, and Senator Bruce Tarr. You know, those are the three Senate conferees. Interesting enough, I actually worked in the Senate at the same time both Senator Tarr and Senator Crean were there. I remember Senator Crean's predecessor, Senator Lois Pines, to give you an idea how I'm dating myself. As soon as you get to a certain age in this gig, you start to date yourself really a lot in the state. I was going to start naming predecessors too many seats deep. But I mean, it was also great to work with folks that I've known for many years on this. And the governor's in the driver's seat. Well, actually, no, he's not. We got it to him on the 21st of July, which means if he vetoes it, it'll be the 31st of July. And if he should do so, the legislature will be in formal session still to override his veto. So we're kind of in a waiting game at this point to see, what he's going to do.
What are some of the highlights of the bill, Jackie? What does it actually do?
Well, the big one, of course, is the procurement of large wind energy off of Block Island. The federal government has opened up a number of, essentially open water, which is owned by the federal government because it's inside federal waters, to long-term lease. And you're not going to build a windmill if no one's going to use your power. I mean, you need a customer before you build. So, you know, this again opens the procurement process for Massachusetts to ask for bids by big wind companies to get a bid process to collect another 600 megawatts of power. So, you know, it's a big deal to continue our shift to big wind as our baseline energy supply. And we worked out ability to ensure that, you know, we're going to get the best rate possible. Not just take the best bid possible. So one of the sticking points between the House and Senate involved the so-called cap on the bid. The Senate wanted to cap the bid process to whatever it was in the original bid process in 2018. Well, it's 2022 and it's different, right? Life has changed. So, you know, the interest, of course, is not to just get wind power, but also get wind power at a good price in the current marketplace. So, you know, that is kind of where we approach the issue in the end, is that, you know, as part of the division of Department of Energy Resources and, you know, going through Department of Public Utilities as well, you know, when the Department of Energy Resources looks at puts the bid prices out, you know, we're looking at the best value for us, not necessarily just the lowest bid. So that's, it makes some sense, but we also don't want to leave one at the table. And in fact, Massachusetts consumes about 49% of all power in New England. We should be a valuable consumer for big wind to get a competitive price. So that's the biggest part of the bill. Other parts include using money for economic development purposes. We want to issue about $35 million in tax credits for industry that are going to have direct impact in terms of windmill construction, meaning that you're going to actually be a manufacturing facility, an assembling facility, fabrication facility. You have to actually be directly related. And we also put some money into workforce training for new jobs into the future associated with big wind.
Okay. Yeah, and I would think the governor would be acceptable to this. Was it not him that set a goal for the state to have zero emissions by, 2050?
Yeah, he did. The Paris Accord did. We did. I mean, it's kind of like this strange date that people just picked out of thin air with no real rhyme or reason of how to do it. I mean, I love these dates, but I mean, the reality is that you only can move as quickly as the power becomes available.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the objective is to wean ourselves off of natural gas because, you know, honestly, it's really natural gas instead of the fossil fuel. I mean, we use no oil and almost no coal. I mean, you know, in terms of energy generation, unless you get a huge peaker situation where we need power desperately.
Right.
Yeah. You know, and baseline load on a normal, non, you know, heat wave day.
Yeah.
We should, you know, it's all natural gas. So we should try to get off natural gas. But to do so, I mean, it's very logical. Before you take natural gas off, you need to put something in to replace it. So, this is like common sense that I never understand why we say this. People look at me like in shock. I mean, I've done this more than once saying, yeah, what you do is you take fossil fuels offline when we get a renewable power online. Then everyone looks at me like it's like a revelation of like, what? I mean, this is like common sense, people. But it's amazing when I talk to folks sometimes, and it's, you know, particularly advocates, I say things like that and look at me like I have 17 heads. It's weird.
Well, I'm sure it's not popular in the fossil fuel industry to say things like that.
Well, I mean, the fossil fuel industry is a dying industry. I mean, you know, they maybe have 400 less years of life left in the industry. This is not a reality just on climate change with these industries. It's actually a reality of having a corporation live for another 1,000 years, so to speak. You know, corporations are designed to outlive human beings. I mean, you know, you look at, you know, even if you look at like family restaurants that have been around since the 1880s, like the Union Oyster House, for example. You know, there's an example of a corporate entity that has outlived, you know, a lot of human beings.
Sure.
To maintain, you know, a business that's there with new owners. So, you know, the fossil fuel industry has to pivot. They do not have a choice. There's plenty of new technology. There's plenty of renewable R&D out there that they're going to make a substantial financial investment in. They already have, and they continue will to try to also be ahead of the game and do acquisitions of renewable power sources as being part of international corporation. So we actually had a conversation, interestingly, with one renewable energy supplier, relatively small player in this industry, but you know, they're a growing purchaser of renewable energy projects. And not surprising, I won't name the company, one of the big fossil fuel companies scooped them up, you know, looking at their portfolio of future growth and had a lot of faith in the team that was there on their investments and acquisitions of renewable energy projects, whether it be an investment in or purchase one outright, that they thought it was worth a long-term risk to buy a company that knows what they're doing. And you'd be surprised if you guys start looking at these energy conglomerates, exactly how much of the portfolio now is really on nuclear, wind, hydro, and also investment in new R&D companies that seem to have viability. And all of them are already invested in battery technology.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they've already pretty much rebranded themselves as energy companies as opposed to, you know, oil or natural gas companies. So, I mean, even if government doesn't act, the private industry is going to push the agenda forward.
Yeah. And these companies are international companies. So, you know, when it involves energy, I mean, they do have investments on a global level where there is allowance for private investment in energy generation. So Europe in particular has industry energy companies that are just really globally oriented. And as we learned from the Ukraine war, you know, fossil fuel energy companies, you know, are a global entity, whether it be a state-owned company like in Russia, you know, privately owned companies in Britain, it really doesn't matter. There's just so much diversity in their portfolios. They really touch every part of the planet.
Yeah, I mean, it would seem to me that government might want to focus on investing in upgrading the grid, you know, the actual infrastructure that the private companies may take advantage of incentives like that.
Yeah, this is an ongoing conversation. President Biden brought this up a few times in his talks about energy, about the national transmission system being, you know, really, really old. And Massachusetts has one of the oldest grid systems in the country. And it's logical when you think about it, because, you know, electricity is really about 120 years old in terms of, you know, residential use. And, you know, we, you know, got it first before other parts west of us, right? So, you know, the grid system's moving westbound, not to say they're that much better shape, but I mean, they're a little bit younger than us. Right. And of course, we have a lot of stuff underground as people like not to look at poles, but there's different consequences of underground wiring. It's hard to get at. You have to dig up a lot of streets to replace. In some cases, not all cases, it can be extremely dangerous to be down in a manhole, as we've seen regarding the explosion actually near my office by Ashburn Place. So, you know, there's a lot of things regarding, you know, utility work, but the utility infrastructure is paid by ratepayers, not by taxpayers, meaning that your electric bill and gas bills pay for the pipes and wires and maintenance and all that stuff. So, if there's going to be an investment on in the distribution system, we're going in transmission system, we need federal assistance. Mm-hmm. But a state could probably put up, you know, some bonds of a few hundred million dollars, you know, maybe even $1 billion. I mean, that just doesn't cover enough. And we have to give it to a privately owned corporation, which, you know, we've done things like this before, biotechnology, but mostly in infrastructure development around biotech and tax credits for biotech, not actually like being an investor in biotech. We didn't buy shares of biotech to give you bond money to use. So it's really more of the, you know, the public infrastructure components. So for us to give tax dollars directly to utilities, whether it be a bond loan or cash, is kind of a real tricky situation because it's, you know, still investment in a private company. If the federal government, if the federal government through FERC decides to pour, you know, federal tax dollars directly into the grid, it'll be a little bit easier because, you know, you run it through FERC to be a regulatory process. It'd be somewhat of a uniform system versus a patchwork. I don't really have a great answer on this one because it's like, you know, do we create tax credits for utility companies to do this? Do we give them bond money as a loan? I mean, I'm not sure what the answer is, but either way.
I see the conundrum. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very tricky to deal with it. But, you know, the bill does have a grid modernization study component. And we do participate in the six New England states energy purchasing, as well as look at the bigger picture ISO New England six state picture as part of that as well. So the bill has some requirements that we go into and participate in studies on a multi-state level as well as domestic, just our state. Yeah. But as you guys can tell, it's tricky for the government to get directly involved in utility companies.
You know, I understand. You know, maybe here's a bombshell, Tacky. The state of Massachusetts electric company.
Well, people remember, you know, old Mass Electric, you know, Edison. I mean, you know, they're gone. We're really down to two utility electric companies, which is a National Grid and an NSTAR. You know, people may remember things like Commonwealth Electric way back.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
So what used to be a dozen plus electrical utilities are now down to two. Gas is a slightly more diverse. I believe there's four, or is it five? I think just Berkshire, NSTAR, NGRID. Liberty is the one in the South Coast, and I'm maybe forgetting a couple. I know Berkshire, Blackstone got bought out finally. The family retired. It's the smallest gas company, I think, in the country. They only served one town, Blackstone.
Right, yeah. I think you're thinking of Eversource.
I'm trying to think of anyone else because I know that Columbia left after the disaster in Lawrence. It's, as you guys can tell, it's been a little while since I had to name utility companies. Since I left the AG's office, it was not a priority to remember where they all were. But also, it's an interstate issue. Anything you do in Massachusetts regarding electrical grid, whether it be energy or gas, you know, it has a ripple effect to our neighboring states. It's the nature of how electricity works. I mean, the grid systems from Halifax, and I think it's like 20 some odd states. So an electron in Ohio or Halifax, you know, we don't know where that electron is.
Mm-hmm. Yep, exactly. Does the bill also include electric vehicle incentives?
Yeah, we do some incentives for electrical vehicles based on the price of the vehicle. Don't ask me off the top of my head what the prices are, but we're looking at vehicles in the $55,000 range, and I think we're looking at tax incentives about $3,500. You know, the goal is to obviously incentivize people to, you know, move to full electric vehicles. And once there's sufficient customer demand, you know, other electric vehicle technology infrastructure will follow it. As I like to say, a gas station was not built before cars were built. Cars were built before the gas station.
Right.
And not surprising, you know, horse and buggy shops started to become horse and buggy and gas, and then fully gas. And, you know, and of course, that's not the case for every community, but I'm just pointing out an example of ability for industry to pivot from one mode of transportation to other, you know, as part of the economy changes. So same thing with electric cars. You need to get a certain level of critical mass of consumers. And, you know, as we pointed out, fossil fuel industry is already pivoting. And I'm a big believer that some point down the road, the car the gas station franchises, or the gas station independent shops, are going to have to make the pivot to electric vehicle charging at some stage. You have to do it safely. Electricity and gas in the same space is a little tricky to deal with, but also the big issues impact on your electric bill. And what do I mean by that? Well, you have to build brand new electrical infrastructure for electrical vehicle charging in large quantities. It's one thing to have one charging station. It's another thing when you have 50 within a quarter square mile, so to speak. And same thing, electrical charging at home will actually have a lot of stress on the wires outside your house. So that, as we pointed out, we need to have grid infrastructure upgrade. Electric vehicles will put stress on that in large volumes. Right now, it's not enough for large volumes, but if you go, if you add, 1.5 million electric cars to the grid at any moment, it actually defeats energy efficiency, which is I've been a proponent of, which is reducing demand. Reducing demand helps the grid immensely, as well as your pocketbook and our need to use fossil fuels. So it's an interesting thing. Again, as I talked about, take out one power out, one point power in, electric vehicles in particular, it's, we got to get ourselves ready for that. And that means ratepayers have to pick up the cost associated for future upgrades, which is why we have a grid modernization study as part of the wind and climate change bill. And, fully weighted Department of Public Utilities has been looking at this for years, as well as the utility companies. And, this will be an ongoing conversation for years to come.
Sure. So what other bills are pending, at least in your bailiwagon, Zaki, you'd like to see approved this week?
Well, I don't have too much in my bailiwagon. I think it's the way, thankfully. I mean, most of my bills are technical bills we've talked about in the past, like the veterinarian renewal license date changes. I mean, we can move those bills in informal session. I've been in conversation with the speaker's office about my low-hanging fruit that no one's going to object to bills, but the little technical ones. That being said, we're watching out for other conference committee reports. I mean, the Conference Committee on Economic Development just was formed this week. You're going to have to do a rapid turnaround. We're still waiting for sports betting. We have a mental health bill. We have a veterans bill. We have a transportation infrastructure bill. what else do we got going on? We're waiting to see what the Senate really does with the cannabis social justice bill, I think is the way to call it. It's, to reform the cannabis industry to have some better small business development as opposed to just being done by big venture capitalists. Mm-hmm. So, we're waiting to see what the Senate wants to do with that kind of stuff. There's some, healthcare stuff out there that I'm not sure what's going to happen regarding pharmacy prices. And, community hospitals were actually addressed as part of ARPA and the last economic development bill. So a lot of the community hospital stuff has been kind of addressed. But, we're looking at like pharmacy pricing and things like that, which I'm not quite sure where we are. The role protections to keep our doctors from being, taken away from us by other states will be on the governor's desk today. That bill came out of conference committee last night, and we'll vote and send it to the governor today. And of course, the governor still has the budget, and he has to give us our vetoes by tomorrow, I believe, because we set it up on a Monday. He has 10 days. So is it tomorrow? Does he Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday? Thursday, he vetoes. We'll come back from the governor and the budget. So we'll be working on those actually probably through the weekend, since the governor has to meet before midnight on Thursday to drop that on us. What else is there? This is a lot going on right now.
And an amendment passed by the Senate to bring back happy hour, Jackie.
Yeah. As you all know, I'm the chairman of the committee on alcohol, and I've stopped. We'll get to the technicalities of how I do things, but I mean, I prevented the movement of happy hour bills in my committee. Not a well done attempt, let's be polite, on trying to put happy hours in the ballot. I mean, that was a ballot question that was formed, but I mean, they're going into signatures, and it was not really a true ballot initiative campaign. So the Senate adopted as part of the economic development bill to allow communities individually decide if they should have happy hours. So it's by local option. There's a huge problem with this because, when it comes to alcohol licensing, we actually have a fairly uniform system. I mean, while each city and town has the ability to determine the hours operations for alcohol industry folks, we pretty much try to keep the alcohol industry fairly uniform. And now we're going to a little bit ancient history, but I mean, during the 1990s, the late 1990s, we tried to resolve some of the issues regarding border communities where, you know, places like New Hampshire and Rhode Island would be able to have liquor stores open on Sundays. Massachusetts blue laws, remember those things? You know, wouldn't allow liquor stores open on Sundays. So we created a situation where you had a 50-mile border. If you're within 50 miles of a border, your liquor store could open on Sundays if they choose to open on Sundays. And that became a bit of a problem because any liquor store at 51 miles from the border is competing against this one in state. So ultimately, this was not a good idea. And we just made it uniform throughout the state to allow liquor stores the option opening on Sundays. Now, even though you have a local option saying that, you know, we authorize happy hours, each individual restaurant may not want to do a happy hour. It is not cost effective for a restaurant. Alcohol is very expensive. Right now it's pretty expensive because supply chain's a mess. It was really cheap, but really cheap there when everything was closed because people just trying to get rid of inventory. So it's amazing how in less than 2 years, how the market shifted really quickly from 2020 shutdown to 2022 inflation.
Simple supply and demand right there. Yeah.
Simple supply and demand. And it becomes like a price war between restaurants and happy hour where there's no winner for the restaurant. So there'd be, you know, it becomes like this price war in a geographic zone. If you're in a sparse community, you know, why would you need happy hour to begin with? And you know, if you're a place where you have limited options, but you have a lot of options, if you start a price war, there's going to be no win among the restaurants.
Right. And not only that, but I mean, what's to prevent one customer in a happy hour community from imbibing and then driving to a non-happy hour community and causing a problem?
Yeah, this is very much a generational issue in the state house, I've noted. So those of us who are old enough remember, or at least sadly had a classmate in school die of drunk driving, generally underage drinking. In some cases, other cases, you know, they're coming home with friends and family, you know, even at like 8 o'clock, and they got killed by a drunk driver, you know, throughout the 80s. Into early 90s. And, you know, that's where MAD and SAD and these other organizations became heavily invested in our schools regarding alcohol and now into substance abuse issues beyond just alcohol. And this was a common occurrence in Massachusetts. Yes. And I'm waiting for my full 2020 numbers and 2021 numbers on driving incidences. But I mean, during COVID lockdown, and we, you know, eventually had to take out alcohol as part of it. I mean, substance abuse drunk driving cases were low, but when you look at the ratio of drivers, was high. Yeah. So even though the raw number is low, well, you have to think about how many cars were on the road. And the ratio, that number is pretty high, but I need to see the final numbers. Triple A had some preliminary ones on the 2020, but I need to see the 2021 numbers to see, get a good comparison. So, you know, a lot of younger folks are kind of like, oh, Uber and Lyft solves this problem. And I tell folks, well, we had taxi cabs and a much less full MBTA, where, you know, people could get on the train and there are cabs galore. So having the Uber or Lyft argument doesn't make sense if you live through that era. And amazingly, when we stopped happy hours in Massachusetts, drunk driving fatalities went down too, especially after work hours. You know, that time period really just was reduced immensely. Combined with better education, stronger drunk driving laws, police and, you know, taking full force of the law on catching folks. And of course, bartender tip training on top of that to identify and overserve. I mean, it's a combination of factors that stemming from the ban of happy hour has really reduced the number of drunk driving instances in the state since the 80s by ratio of vehicles. So, you know, it really is interesting inside this, still in this conversation. It really is age driven.
Right. Yeah. Folks like you and I remember those times and lost people close to us to drunk driving related incidents. Since then, you know, as you mentioned, the instances of that have gone way down. So younger people don't know what we're talking about.
No, they don't. And it's kind of interesting. Like I said, it's very interesting in this conversation. It's clearly a generational issue, very much so. And not understanding that, you know, all those things I described, you know, took, you know, 20 years to have an impact, truly an impact on reducing drunk driving.
Yeah.
So,
in fact, I think the senator that introduced it is of a younger generation.
Yeah, Senator Julian Cyr from the Cape. Yeah. The argument I heard listening to Grapevine, I was told that the argument is because Provincetown is a walkable town on restaurants that, you know, happy hours are perfectly acceptable. No, drunken disorder in the middle of the street is not acceptable to begin with. Those of us who travel and watch people stumble on the streets, you know, hammered, remember the eras of even the pubs in Southie or in Quincy or Dorchester or anywhere else, you know, people just, you know, completely blasted. You, your families, and you're looking at that. No one wants that either.
Right. No, I'm sure there'll be some public safety advocates that are going to come forward and remind folks of those times.
Yeah. And Provincetown is a tourist community. I mean, during the summertime in particular, I mean, it's almost 200% the size of the regular population. So the argument walking is not true. I mean, people do day trips out there to come in and come out. So
actually travel long distances, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And it's not just everybody on the ferry either. Not everybody's coming off Long Wharf. So I get it. But at the same time, though, it's kind of a very, I'm sorry to say, Julian, it's a very limited view of how the world works. I'm sorry to tell you that on video. This ain't Mark Crosby, so it's not like it's be transmitted to the Cape. But
that's right. Although I'm sure he's heard it face to face.
I mean, yeah, as you said, you have to be a certain age. I've been around longer. I've been doing alcohol policy for a very, very long time.
Well, isn't it true, though, of any kind of legislation that tries to specifically target individual cities and towns? It's you know, we live in a commonwealth, right? So it does impact the entire state.
Yeah, we've done this before, too. Remember smoking restaurants? That was patchwork until the state had to intervene. Buying cigarettes at age 21, again, another thing that was patchwork until the state intervened. One of the ones that we're going to have to look at down the road is banning nips. Mobile communities, not that many yet, but, you know, mobile communities have already started banning nips in liquor stores.
Including Quincy,
Including Quincy, and that's going to have to be addressed on a statewide level at some point down the road. And there have been proposals to make them part of the bottle bill. That may not be the solution. Bottle bill effectiveness diminishes once you get away from dense urban. It doesn't have the same benefit to it. Suburban communities, more sparse communities, bottle bill doesn't have the same effect. We may be moving towards banning nips. I'm not sure yet. Actually, it's not my committee overseas. That is telecom utilities and energy, because it's considered part of the bottle bill and environmental recycling. It's weird. I just don't ask. It's part of that committee for some reason. Okay. No, we're going to have to move that direction. I mean, we've done all kinds of things at our level to ensure uniformity, because these towns just move independently on their own.
Yeah. Speaking of, I read a survey not too long ago. I forget who did it. That participation in recycling Massachusetts is down considerably from just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, it's a little confusing too, because not all your recyclable little symbol on your plastic and paper containers are recyclable. Countries overseas don't want our trash anymore.
Right.
It's been real problematic for communities to find companies to take all recyclable products. They only want specific recyclable products. And you will say a town will cure some financial impact for having to run recyclables. So, you know, people are looking carefully at their containers and realizing this can be recycled and this can't. And recycling and trash is like a global industry, of which first world countries generate the most of it, namely, you know, guys that look like us. Less wealthy countries don't generate nearly the volume of trash that we do. And they have a tendency, of course, trying to make things last a whole lot longer and less disposable. So I really have a problem with the disposal economy. My mind can't get around that. It's like, why are we creating disposable items for people regularly? But whatever, it's the century we live in. So, I mean, that's one of the big factors. And some communities have moved to a single stream recycling where everything goes into the same container and it gets sorted out later on. Like I said, there's some inconsistencies on how recycling works in terms of each community, because each community needs to pay for it themselves as part of trash pickup. So it's, you know, negotiated contract, and Some people who may be listening to this that lives in a town where you have to take it to the dump yourself. Mm-hmm. You do your recycling at the dump in some cases.
Yep.
And then you also have communities where you have to pay per bag. I mean, you have to pay per bag of trash.
Right.
Yep. The town will bill you. Garbage pickup, non-conformed between communities, because communities actually ones have to pay those costs. And my favorite story is always ones where people, you move like from Quincy to a little town and realize they have to like take the trash to the dump, and suddenly they get there, there's like an extra fee they have to pay at the dump. And like, what is this?
It's quite a culture shock. Yeah,
it is. They can't get rid of a couch easily. It's all kinds of like, my friends are like, what is this? I'm getting used to it. Why can't you still take everything? I'm like, well, you're paying a low property tax, low service community. That's what happens.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that is one of the biggest culture shocks for folks who move away from communities that are full service collection.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is kind of part of the challenge of recycling. It's truly an economic issue at a global level.
Want to switch gears a little bit, Tacky, and talk international affairs?
Sure, why not? We just moved into the international trash conversation.
Nancy Pelosi wants to go to Taiwan. China's not happy about that.
Yeah, this is a delayed trip. Nancy Pelosi was looking to go to Taiwan prior to COVID hitting, so this was not a new news. But a lot changed in the last couple of years, as we know, including international affairs that has nothing to do with the pandemic. The Hong Kong protests seems like ancient history, right? That went on essentially nearly 2 years, and the government cracked down on it, and now the new national security law that makes it impossible to talk about the government at all in a negative way, and banning independent newspapers, trying to erase Tiananmen Square from all over the island, essentially, and then actually engaging in an international manhunt by the Chinese government to find people who support financially like Tiananmen Square memorials, is causing a lot of panic and fear in Taiwan, and should cause panic and fear in all the neighboring countries at the moment. What they've done to Hong Kong, even though, it's China, I mean, let's call it what it is. It's not an independent country, but it had the most autonomous freedoms of all of China. Very more Western, well, more British because it's a British colony, but I mean more Western-ish. It's not American, folks. It's more Western-ish because it was a British colony. It's freaking out a lot of folks out there, and especially the Taiwanese, which the Chinese government considers a rogue province, is already a property of China. And the international community does not recognize Taiwan as a country, but does recognize its economic development zone, which is how we kind of skirt international recognition issue. To see what's happening in Ukraine, the claim is you're one of us, you belong to us. Now, there is a difference. Ukraine is a sovereign nation. Not Taiwan is not a sovereign nation recognized by the world. But, they have a similar fear. And, since the Hong Kong protests, Western countries have stepped up on being outspoken regarding the treatment of what we consider civil liberties on an island that had been enjoying those civil liberties since the handover from the British to the Chinese. And Taiwan, again, is not, us exactly, a Western country, but they do hold a lot of similar Western values, including things like freedom of press, a parliamentary system of a government, they have a democratic republic. They have a free commerce system, they're part of international banking industry. They do have agreements regarding freedom of travel in and out of the country, whether you require a visa, freedom of travel, and also international reciprocation of driver's license. Massachusetts allows Taiwanese residents and that live here, I'm going to say Taiwanese folks that are residents in Massachusetts to use their Taiwanese driver's license to get a Massachusetts driver's license.
No, I didn't know that.
We actually quite a few countries. There's a list online you can look because they have sufficient driving standards at home and driving education that meets our requirements that we will do that. So as long as you don't have a bunch of things that make you lose your license at home, you'll be fine getting your license here. They yank your license in Taiwan, you're not getting one here.
Right.
In many ways, it's like Japan and South Korea, Singapore. And I know that there's trouble in the governments of Malaysia and Indonesia. If you look at the news, they got some issues, but I mean, there are parliamentary systems, so they're democratic republics. Mm-hmm. So Nancy Pelosi arriving would be the third highest ranking official in the U.S., right? The president, vice president, and speaker of the House is the order of succession. And we've had U.S. senators and congressmen already go over to Taiwan multiple times over the course of the last decade. But having someone as high ranking, because I think the last one that went there was Newt Gingrich. That was a long time ago. The third highest ranking in terms of the Constitution official to go to Taiwan. Creates more credibility for Taiwan being more of an independent sovereign nation. This won't sit well with the Chinese government, who feels that any foreign entity that shows up, particularly a major trade partner, major defense provider, shows up, undermines their authority in the country. And right. This is a state visit. This isn't like a vacation trip. She's going there as an official state visit.
Oh yeah, oh yeah, and they've put a pretty strong response out to that. So it'd be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, anytime the U.S. government sends high-ranking officials to anywhere, it legitimizes more the government that's there, which is why there's a lot of caution, particularly with the president, on where the president goes, because if this is the thing about Donald Trump and North Korea that was mind-boggling for me. Because it was, all you're doing is creating legitimacy for a government that basically, murders people on a regular basis for doing nothing wrong other than, looking at him the wrong way. So, when Trump met, Kim Jong-un, all he did was give him more legitimacy among the North Korean people that he stands on equal footing with the evil American empire, right? I mean, that's how they look at it. That's the propaganda he puts out. We're the evil American power. The West is trying to crush us. Look, I'm with the U.S. president. I'm staying on equal footing as the most powerful nation in the world, a little hermit country. Yeah, that's how he sells it at home. And he created legitimacy that really we shouldn't encourage.
Absolutely, but there is, like you say, the propaganda that they only see. That's all they are allowed to see and allowed to believe.
Yeah, and as soon as that propaganda met Kim Jong-un's needs, he started testing missiles again pretty quickly, right? Mm-hmm. And reactivated his nuclear program. So, I mean, this is like common sense in my mind, but there's also domestic politics. As I said multiple times, a lot of stuff that you see in the news regarding the behavior of international affairs has nothing to do with us. It's everything to do with internal politics, whether to maintain their seats of power or address economic crisis. But more times than not, is to maintain their seats of power.
Yep.
Everyone needs a good boogeyman to sell at home to maintain your position. Nothing like causing fear to ask for stability, right? Not unusual political behavior. So we do this too in the U.S. It's not like the U.S. hasn't done this as well. Create bogeymen so people will support certain domestic policies.
Saddam Hussein, right, is a good example.
Saddam Hussein, the yellow scare, the red scare, the Mexican scare. now you have replacement theory scare. You have all these scares. What they are in the end is to push an agenda for people to maintain power in a local level. And it's easy to pick on a foreign government or foreign people because of their receipt. I mean, I'll tell you right now, Joe Schmo, Chinese person, in China, does not care about what is going on over here. They're more concerned about inflation like we are, putting food on the table. I mean, and if the government says that we're evil, sure, why not, right? What does it mean to that person?
Right.
I don't want to deal with American imperialists. All right, fine. Well, support the government that keeps us safe, right? Sounds familiar, right? This is what happens here too. It's not unusual behavior among politicians and government officials to try to maintain power or push public policies that may be unpopular. So that's kind of the whole Taiwan issue. I mean, they're right now doing drills. Put into their mandatory military training requirement, more stringent requirements than ever had before. They've made a mass amount of purchases of anti-missile defense in the U.S. They've increased the military spending and will do so in the next 5 years. And they've ramped up, you know, obviously international recognition in terms of like, you know, maintaining relations. And again, 50% of all microchips on the planet are made in Taiwan. Mm-hmm. And they're not shy about reminding people of that. Don't let us get bombed. You're going to lose your microchips. And given the fact that we've already felt the supply chain impact for 2 years on shortage of chips, the idea of bombing an island that makes half of our chips, just saying.
I think cars are expensive now. Just wait. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, get used to the iPhone. You've been using that for a long time.
Yeah, exactly. So part of the reason why I brought it up, because it does have an impact here at home for sure.
Yeah. As we learned through a pandemic, you know, we're a global economy. And, you know, law of economics says they create specialties. It's more efficient to have specialties around the world than trying to be, you know, jack of all trade. We're not as efficient. So, yeah, Taiwan is important to us. Not necessarily just a, you know, friend. And we do have a lot of people from Taiwan that live here in Massachusetts. The largest concentration is located in the city of Newton. But also, you know, selfishly, let's be selfish a bit, you know, regarding international trade. They, you know, they're a big part of our economy, not just microchips, but also medicine, food. You know, we export a lot of food over there. You know, Costco's there. And it's a hub point for many businesses to access Asia. Now that Hong Kong has become much more challenging, mm-hmm. You know, Taiwan has really continued to bloom as a location, as a hub port. And we do have a nonstop from Boston to Taiwan.
Running up against the clock today, Techie, but we should let folks know how to get a hold of you and if you'll be available after the session ends.
Well, I would like to be less available after the session ends, for at least for a little while. But, you know, obviously we'll always reach about 617-722-2370, 617-722-2370. This is a new phone number. I know I'm reminding folks 2 months afterwards, but you'd be surprised. I'll be remembering an old phone number, including myself. My email box is a little tamer now. Tacky.chan@mahouse.gov, TACKEY.CHAN at mahouse.gov. State Representative Tacky Chan Facebook. We're not been as busy on that right now because we're trying to get our press releases out to the Quincy Sun as more bills kind of, you know, hit. We've been really trying to get our news into the local paper. As quick as we can. We're going to make poor Bob a little crazy over there as we're trying to get these releases out to him. The problem of crush of a session is we try to have a lot of news. And then, of course, tachan.org needs an update. We've been drowning right now, so we haven't got a chance to do updates, so we'll get there. And obviously, those who want to have a newsletter, you know, HouseNet Community Council, you know, I'm in their bulletin once a month. So, you know, if you feel like helping out a local organization, you know, please subscribe to the HouseNet Community Council's bulletin. You know, you'll find me in there too.
Excellent. Maybe we can check in next week, find out what passed and what didn't.
Yeah, I will know on August 31st what's on the governor's desk, and governor's vetoes will be, let's see, the 31st will be around August 10th-ish, where the governor has to get those vetoes out to us on stuff that are passed on the 31st. Right, I get this really confused. It was August 9th. It's 10 days. It, 10-day clock clicks on the day it gets the governor's desk. So 31. So it'll be August 9th, August 10th, but mostly August 9th. There'll be a lot of action on governor's vetoes. Anything we pass this week, again, you know, going to the first couple of weeks of August. So my office, myself, will be doing a whole lot of monitoring right into the first 2 weeks of August to try to figure what happens.
Sounds good. Good to talk to Tacky as always.
As always, Joe, and we'll see you in a week.